question. Now we're going to take a look at the hazard mitigation sector, and we'll be hearing from both Alessandra Gerolman and Kelly Klima. Kelly Klima is a research scientist at the Department of Engineering and Public Policy of Carnegie Mellon University, focusing on climate, extreme weather, energy, communications, and outreach. She serves on the American Geophysical Union Executive Council and the Natural Hazard Mitigation Association Board of Directors. In addition to research, she founded the SUCCEED program, which is the Summer Center for Climate, Energy, and Environment Decision Making, which is a program designed to complement ninth grade student education and provide them with opportunities to expand their understanding of energy and environment and how those relate to climate change. Kelly has a doctorate in engineering and public policy from Carnegie Mellon University, a master's in earth, atmospheric, and planetary science, and a master's in aeronautics and astronautics from the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, and a bachelor's in mechanical engineering from Caltech. We'll also be hearing from Alessandra Gerolman, who is the founder and executive director of the Natural Hazard Mitigation Association. She also owns a consulting practice specializing in building resilience, hazard mitigation, and training. Her work experience includes serving as a program specialist in the Gulf Coast with Save the Children USA, working on a resilience initiative around children's needs in emergencies, hazard mitigation planning at the local, state, and campus level, and community education and outreach regarding mitigation measures and preparedness. Alessandra currently serves as one of the tri-chairs for the Natural Hazard Mitigation Collaborative Alliance, and she sits on the board of the Greater New Orleans Disaster Recovery Partnership. She is currently a doctoral candidate at the University of New Orleans. So with that, I will turn things over to Kelly and Alessandra for their presentation.
Thanks. And today we're going to talk a bit about integrating adaptation and hazard mitigation planning efforts. And first, we'll talk a little bit about what is the Natural Hazard Mitigation Association, and then we'll double check, you know, what is hazard mitigation, what are challenges to successful hazard mitigation, and we'll take a look at some examples from state and local levels, places that are integrating hazard mitigation and climate adaptation into their planning, and some funding resources that can be leveraged. NHMA was founded in 2008 to bring together the various individuals and organizations working in the field of hazard mitigation. And to us, this also includes climate adaptation. We believe through sharing approaches and tools, we can work together to build a safer, more sustainable society. And here's a picture of the founding members of our Resilient Neighbors Network, which we'll share a bit more about shortly. And it's no news to everyone on this call, but we face risks every day, and alone we just can't protect ourselves. We are already having troubles dealing with current hazards, such as Superstorm Sandy, shown here, and projected climate change impacts will further tap our skills and tax our available resources. We really need to work together to take this window of opportunity, or any window of opportunity that arises, and educate policymakers about ways to build a safer, more sustainable society. Two groups with a lot in common are hazard mitigation and adaptation professionals. Here's one of the definitions you might see for risk, where it's a hazard, for instance, a thunderstorm or a hurricane, times the exposure, the number of people in the storm's way, times the vulnerability, how likely those buildings and people are to break. And it's a little more complicated, but that general functionality will work. And we see that the definitions of hazard mitigation and adaptation are very similar. Hazard mitigation reduces exposure and vulnerability as informed by past events. Adaptation, on the other hand, reduces exposure and vulnerability and is informed by future projections. And the Natural Hazard Mitigation Association really works to foster collaboration between these two communities, which have so much in common. So a little more basic, what is hazard mitigation? A hazard is any sort of natural, man-made, or technological problem. And in this, we are a little bit different than adaptation, which tends to look more at climate and natural problems. And mitigation is reducing, relieving, or alleviating something. So FEMA's definition is that hazard mitigation is any cost-effective action taken to eliminate or reduce the long-term risk to life and property from natural and technological hazards. Successful hazard mitigation will break the cycle of destruction, rebuilding, and destruction again. Here's a picture of Miami Beach in 1926 after a big hurricane, and Miami Beach again in 2006. And we're really looking at different ways to reduce the damages, to break the cycle, and prevent this reoccurring reconstruction, which is often more expensive as the years go by. Hazard mitigation addresses both short and long term. It can do anything from your firefighter's emergency first response to things all the way down from building codes to land use planning and coastal zone management. And hazard mitigation also benefits stakeholders in multiple ways. It helps reduce the life of lost property, essential services, facilities, and economic hardship, and it will reduce short-term and long-term recovery and reconstruction costs. And it will also help increase cooperation and communication across the community and increase the potential for state and federal funding for recovery and reconstruction projects. You can see a lot of this is very similar to what climate adaptation professionals think about, need, and benefit from. So who can practice hazard mitigation? Well, there are a ton of different mitigation activities that can be done by individuals, businesses, government. You know, we have Smokey the Bear, only you can prevent forest fires, or the Three Little Pigs, or a little cartoonish perhaps, but you can be part of the solution to break the disaster cycle by being aware of the hazards that affect you and your community and become active in your community's hazard mitigation planning process. And really, hazard mitigation, the big thing with it is that it plans really only using past events at this point in time. And as our president, Ed Thomas, would say, that's about as safe as driving down a highway 80 miles an hour using your rear view mirrors only. Not so safe. Adaptation, on the other hand, requires us to look forward as well. Unfortunately, there are a bunch of institutional policy and communication barriers. One of the big ones is externality. When a classic example is a park bench, when one group pays to maintain or replace it, and yet a different person uses it. And we see in disaster assistance, this is another classic example of an externality. And some of the ways that we can solve this are looking at some of the programs moving forward. For instance, NFIP, especially through the Community Rating Service System, has made a good start at solving this problem. But alone, NFIP will not be enough. A second possibility is a fear of a taking or a regulation that effectively results in the government exercising eminent domain without actually taking your property. And what we see is that hazard mitigation does have a strong legal basis, and there's a lot of things you can do, safe development, low-impact development, water resource management, that are legal, equitable, practical, and defensible in court. And so the regulations that are clearly based on hazard prevention and fairly applied to all are almost never, ever successfully held to be a taking. So it's not something we should worry about as much. Another challenge is that some public officials believe they are immune to lawsuits for the consequences of actions which harm others. Many floodplain managers have told NHMA that such an attitude is making their jobs, of course, much more difficult. And moving forward, including public officials in workshops and speeches and just communicating with them more will help decrease the likelihood of this problem occurring. When you have the chance to reach out and they understand a little better where you're coming from, this challenge can more easily be surmounted. And of course, some folks sincerely and most definitely believe they know exactly what climate change is. They think that is a vast left-wing conspiracy involving government seizure of private property or some sort of attempt through the UN to destroy America's private enterprise system and eventually destroy the United States. Basically, a fervent belief that it's hooey or some sort of plot. For these sorts of folks, we can't really convince them that climate change actually exists. Instead, we need to speak to them in their language. And that may mean that we never mention the word climate and instead talk about things such as economic savings of green infrastructure over gray, as alluded to by one of the earlier presenters. And many state and regional governments are beginning to incorporate hazard mitigation and climate adaptation plans. And a couple of the following examples are adapted from the National Adaptation Forum presentation given by Ryan Towell, who's a project manager at Dewberry. And I'd like to thank him for letting me use some of these slides. Maryland, for instance, in 2008, their version of the Hazard Mitigation Plan had a limited mention of climate change. In 2011, with the state being so proactive, it was time to start integrating climate change and state efforts underway. And so Maryland's 2011 Hazard Mitigation Plan includes adaptation, and it actually states that climate change is a potential amplifier of existing natural hazards. And the plan includes a critical risk assessment and potential future impacts on hazards frequency, intensity, and distribution. In California, 2010, the state Hazard Mitigation Plan added significant climate change elements, where they were saying that climate change was a factor intensifying impacts of many natural hazards. As of April 2012, California now has a draft framework for local and regional adaptation planning. Wisconsin, similarly, has begun to discuss the issues regarding climate change, and we see that in their FEMA Region 5 crosswalk suggestion that the next plan update should include a more detailed risk assessment for climate change and more detailed treatment of mitigation strategies. Locally, we see several examples as well. Santa Cruz has probably one of the most drastic changes from a typical hazard mitigation plan into the one that includes climate adaptation. They made an effort to create a very integrated plan, including how climate change will impact different city operations. And this includes climate action plan, a general plan, and emergency operation plans. Additionally, Lewis, Delaware has integrated climate change into hazard mitigation. That's another famous example. And one thing to take away from that is, of course, their biggest project challenge, which was the nomenclature. Things like, what does hazard mitigation mean? What does greenhouse gas mitigation mean? And climate adaptation. And we've discussed that a bit today. So now I'll pass it over to Alessandra for a bit on where we get the funding.
I wanted to start off by talking about something that I think has come up in pretty much every presentation, and it's what I would call multi-objective management. It's basically finding ways to work with others, with other stakeholders, other interests, and identifying the shared goals and the shared value spaces. And there really are a lot of them between hazard mitigation, climate adaptation, public health, water quality, parks and recreation, and the list goes on and on. And in a time of shrinking resources, the ability to leverage programs, both in terms of funding and technical assistance, but also in terms of finding the ways to take advantage of the opportunities presented, for example, by a street that already needs to be repaired or in the aftermath of a disaster. And so the following slides are really in that context of multi-objective management, discussing developing projects and programs that have broad constituencies where it's possible to really build that interest for undertaking these sometimes challenging projects. NHMA has a guidebook called the Patchwork Quilt, which is available on our website. Now, the Patchwork Quilt is really about the post-disaster environment, but it has a lot of applications. And at the most basic, the Patchwork Quilt is about multi-objective management. It's about identifying community needs, wants, desires, and pulling together solutions, essentially by creating a patchwork of resources, technical assistance, funding, and otherwise to make things happen. And I think this is something that you might find useful, and I'll say that I actually found a few additional references we'll be including in the future from the previous presentations. This slide covers a little bit of information on technical assistance. Now, it's a fine line between technical assistance and funding, because some of the programs that we'll talk about really do provide both. Or at times, technical assistance, it takes the place of small amounts of funding and very targeted assistance, site visits, the bringing of staff resources to bear from agencies, departments, organizations. And at other times, it's simply the availability of publications and other types of resources that can be quite useful. Now, it's pretty much impossible for me to cover even the range of organizations that we would interact with in the field of mitigation in the time that's allowable for this webinar. But with this slide, I wanted to just give you a feel for really how wide that range is. And I chose to highlight planning for recovery because planning for recovery prior to an event, going through an exercise of saying, what are some of the challenges that might arise if such and such were to happen? What might happen if there was another Superstorm Sandy, for example? That is an opportunity to be prepared to take advantage of the opportunities that can arise following a large event. And that doesn't even have to be an event that takes place in your own community. It can be taking advantage of an event in a similar community as a means of opening the conversation or discussion But when a community is impacted, for better or for worse, it does open the door to some additional resources and technical assistance. And so being prepared to take advantage of that on the front end, having identified the ways in which some of the climate adaptation measures might fit into recovery to post-disaster mitigation efforts, it's a good way of making sure that that can happen. Because otherwise, you're trying to push a rather large rock uphill when everybody's so very busy, overworked, going through recovery, including personal impacts. That's a pretty difficult time to, as we say in emergency management, exchange business cards. So the more of that happens on the front end, the better. And also, as you can see, there are a lot of agencies, federal, state, local, regional authorities, there are community groups, there are businesses, universities, nonprofit organizations, foundations, all of which are very active in providing technical assistance and resources. And sometimes it's too much. There's so much out there that navigating it gets quite challenging. But having a feel for what is out there is very useful. And peer networking as well, which I'll talk about in a little bit, is one way for communities to help each other to navigate this process. The patchwork quilt as a concept is a way to make the best of a challenging process, because there really is so very much out there, and what's useful out of it is sometimes rather piecemeal. And then talking about obtaining funding, as I mentioned earlier, some of these same agencies that can provide technical assistance also provide funding. Now, as everybody knows, funding from federal agencies is often dependent on appropriations, federal budget. It can be limited. It can be dependent on particular initiatives or project types. And so it's not always the answer, but it's one piece of the solution. Other sources of funding can be foundations, and they can also be individual actions, actions by community members themselves, actions by local businesses. And education can play a key role in promoting some of those actions. And there are also several resources available as far as other ways of promoting individual action. In this next slide, it really just shows some of those groups that can be active in providing resources. Sorry, there's a little lag on the slide. Here it is. You see the Army Corps of Engineers Silver Jackets program that's very active in several states. You'll see some community organizations, some nonprofits like FireWise that provide, for example, model ordinances and other information along those lines that can also be quite useful. And finally, coming back to peer networking, which I mentioned earlier, there are several organizations that are working to build networks to help communities talk to each other about what's working, how they're overcoming challenges, and help each other out. One of those is the Resilient Neighbors Network, which NHMA manages, and you can find more information on our website. It's 10 pilot communities that came together to talk to each other, help each other out, again, share information. And one thing that they've been able to do for each other as well is actually to leverage funding opportunities, because when one community accesses technical assistance or participates in a program, they can then share that information to the rest of the network. And so it magnifies the impact and helps them in seeking funding as well. And with that, you can see here contact information for Kelly and myself, should anybody have any questions or comments in the future, or any suggestions for additional resources for Patchwork Quilt, which we are always looking for.
All right. Thank you, Kelly and Alessandra, for your presentation. If anyone has questions for either of them, please feel free to enter them into the GoToMeeting panel. During their presentation, they mentioned a couple of things that I wanted to highlight, particularly thinking about communicating with your stakeholders in a way that is effective and resonates. I encourage folks to check out our files and recording from our first webcast, where we covered this topic in a lot of detail, and there's some great strategies there. And so certainly the hazard mitigation community is an ideal partner for working on adaptation. There's also a lot of connections to the public health community in hazard mitigation, so some great ideas for our audience there. We're going to quickly do a last poll question and then move into a combined session of panel questions and questions we receive from the audience, since we are a bit short on time, and any questions that we aren't able to get to, we will provide responses on our website in writing. So very quickly, for our last poll, which partners from which sectors may provide the most immediate opportunity to help seek adaptation funding in your entity? So who is your organization considering working with or looking at as an ideal partner for pursuing adaptation? Folks could take a minute just to quickly respond to this. We'd like to get your input. Okay, we're going to have to pull the answers quickly here just to get a quick sense. So 51% water and utilities, 43% hazard mitigation or national security, which is great. About a quarter folks are looking at public health, about a third at transportation, and 20% at environmental services. And I imagine a lot of folks on the line today are from there.